Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audiocast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include human enhancement, bioethics and emerging technologies, cosmology, metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, and as usual, I will be your host for the program. If it sounds like I'm a little bit under the weather, it's because I am. I've been battling a cold for the last 3 or 4 days. Spent the weekend pretty much lit up in bed, moaning and groaning and feeling very, very sorry for myself. I'm a very poor, sick person. I'm a grouch when I'm not feeling well. Not a very fun person to be around. But I'm hoping to kick this thing off soon, get rid of it, and start to feel like myself again. And, there's solace in the fact that I think this show is actually looking like a really good show. So if you'll bear with me in my nasally voice today, I have some content that I think will make up for it. I'm going to start off the program talking about an interview that I had. It wasn't really an interview. It was a conversation I had with Tanya Jones of Alcor back in August of last year when I was in Chicago for Transvision 2007. We had a fascinating conversation about Alcor and cryonics and the state of the industry, and I'll relay some of that conversation I had with her to you today. The second item that I want to talk about today is the Drake equation, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It's the famous equation set up by Drake, some 40, 60 years ago or so, that was meant for us to give us an idea, a rough idea, just how many extraterrestrial civilizations are out there. And I'm going to talk about why that's somewhat out of date now, somewhat of an outdated notion, and that it's not really helpful. And lastly, I want to talk about Anonymous, yes, that Anonymous, the hacktivist group working on the internet these days quite clandestinely and in a distributed manner in their effort to quote-unquote wipe Scientology off the internet. I've got a couple things to say about that, as I'm sure you know. And that looks like a good lineup for today. All right, we'll get things started right after this track.
Watch the hands move across your face. If I were only Bing, moving slow, the longest race, the sharpest teeth sink, and I can't move, and I can't see. The needle clicks through all that lace.
You know, it's funny how these things go. There I was at the Transvision 2007 celebrity reception in late July. I was drinking white wine and munching on hors d'oeuvres and eagerly awaiting the arrival of none other than William Shatner. I was looking forward to what was going to be really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I was sitting at a table with James Hughes, and I realized none other than Tanya Jones, the chief operating officer for Alcor. And I'd never met Tanya before, and I've yet to visit the Alcor facility in Arizona, and I was very, very impressed with her Transvision presentation from earlier in the week, and I was bursting with questions. There's a lot of things that were on my mind. So we were sitting there, and we were waiting for Shatner to arrive, and we began to chat. And we had a wonderful conversation, and I asked her a number of questions, and we kind of hit it off and just had a great conversation for really what ended up being about 30, 45 minutes or so. Now, during her talk 2 days prior, Tanya gave conference attendees the rundown on some of Alcor's more recent work and initiatives. It was a fascinating glimpse into the world of cryonics and what it takes to run a company that's really on the technological and social outskirts. She noted how Alcor teams can be rushed to the bedside of dying patients as they ready for the suffusion of cryoprotectants in preparation for cryopreservation. This is a, well, without this highly engineered liquid, preservation would be completely disastrous because each cell would suffer a number of problems, including extensive ice crystallization and the eventual threat of it losing all of its physical integrity. And these cryoprotectant gels, which really, they replace the blood after death. All the blood is removed from the body and replaced with a cryoprotectant. It really, what it does is it converts the body into a glass-like structure or a glass-like state, so to preserve the maximal amount of information. And yes, the body's informational state is thus retained at the highest level that's at least currently possible. And consequently, getting the patient into cold storage as quickly as possible is paramount. As Tanya noted during her presentation, time is trauma. And during the cocktail reception, I asked her how long would be too long, and she replied that any kind of delay is detrimental, but that after 24 hours, that's when the real serious and irrevocable damage starts to occur, most notably in cellular degradation and a host of other neural problems, as the brain at this point, after about a day or so, it begins to lose its cohesion and organization. And quite obviously, the brain is the most critical thing that you want to preserve. And I asked her if Alcor had a policy for refusing to treat severely damaged patients, say like a person had been terribly damaged by autopsy or by a motor vehicle accident. And she answered that in such cases where information theoretic death is all but assured, it's not up to Alcor, but instead up to the predetermined wishes of the Alcor member. When an individual signs up with Alcor, they specify the various extremes to which they will still agree to be cryopreserved, and Alcor will unquestioningly adhere to those wishes. Tanya also described the freezing process, which is done under strictly controlled conditions. The body is slowly brought down to the optimally low temperature and is carefully monitored for tissue fracturing. And quite frustratingly, every preservation that has ever been conducted at Alcor has suffered from fracturing of some sort. Tanya, she described the sound as similar to ice cubes popping when added to a drink. When she said that, I squirmed in my seat, wondering how our high-tech descendants will repair this kind of information theoretic brain damage. These cracks, if you will. Fractures. And you know, I was impressed with Tanya's honesty. She was very upfront about everything in terms of, you know, some of their successes, but also some of their limitations. And I thought that by being open about these limitations, Alcor, they come across as being less interested in the cell aspect and more concerned about creating a credible and legitimate industry. And along these lines, I asked Tanya about regulation and whether or not she believes there will ever be such a thing as a monitored cryonics industry. Not only did she agree, she is convinced that it is inevitable and that a big battle is looming. But Alcor, she said, is ready. She quickly outlined her plans to me and a strategy for what she thinks will be a long and drawn-out struggle to get the kind of regulation in place that would be to the benefit of Alcor and the burgeoning industry of cryonics, a battle that she believes will come sooner rather than later. You know, as it currently stands, Alcor is regulated under the Anatomical Gift Act, which really makes Alcor a kind of glorified research lab and organ storage facility, which I suppose is better than being acknowledged as a funeral parlor. But it's this lack of recognition and backwards thinking that has arguably landed Alcor in trouble in the past. Remember that scandalous Ted Williams affair? Well, Tanya claims that it's finally all over and done with. But it's an example of how a new and unrecognized industry, really an industry on the fringe, it can face undue challenges and public scrutiny, some of it unfair. More formal and cogent regulation will not only give Alcor needed credibility as they work to create a viable business, it'll also result in a safer and more effective industry. Now, interestingly, while Alcor today is primarily concerned with cryopreservation, they are also looking ahead to a time when cellular repair will finally become possible. They project themselves as being an all-in-one facility, what I dubbed as being a facility interested in going from the grave to the cradle. Today, they cryopreserve people, Tomorrow, they hope to be the company that restores health to those that are cryopreserved. Now, to this end, they are creating a research lab in which rats will be cryopreserved and experimented upon. This approach makes perfect sense. It's going to allow them to not just look ahead, but to also gauge the effectiveness of current preservation procedures and technologies. I joked with Tanya about their use of rats. I thought, you know, the thought of a little cryonics lab filled with frozen rats and tiny doers is unsettling. I mean, who wants to see a revived rat running around? Why couldn't they have used, you know, cute little bunny rabbits instead? It would have been much better PR to see a bunch of revived bunny rabbits hopping around. When I said that, Tanya laughed, but she noted how animal experimentation will likely escalate to eventually include larger animal models. I have yet to sign up for cryonics. My reasons are, admittedly, personal, complicated, and even nonsensical. There may come a time when I reconciled my broader existential outlook with the prospect of cryonics. Until then, however, I will laud the efforts of Alcor and continue to advocate for the right to a long life. They are certainly blazing a fascinating trail into the future. Oh, and I totally missed the opportunity to meet William Shatner. I barely even noticed that he was in the room when I was chatting with Tanya. Now, why do you suppose I have absolutely no regrets about that? You know, I'm surprised how often the Drake equation is still mentioned when people discuss such things as the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI, astrobiology, and problems like the Fermi paradox. You know, fairly recent insights in such fields as cosmology, astrobiology, and various future studies have changed our perception of the cosmos and the ways in which advanced life might develop. Frank Drake developed his equation back in 1961, and it leaves much to be desired in terms of what it's supposed to tell us about both the nature and predominance of extraterrestrial life in our galaxy. The Drake equation, if you've seen it, N equals, and there's a string of variables. The variables include the following. Well, N, by the way, N equals the number of civilizations in our galaxy with which we might hope to be able to communicate. That's ultimately what the Drake equation is supposed to tell us. And to find the value of N, we take R, which is the average rate of star formation in our galaxy, and we take the fraction of those stars that have planets. Then we take the average number of planets that can potentially support life per star that has planets. Then we take the fraction of the above that actually go on to develop life at some point. And then we take the fraction of that that can actually go on to develop intelligent life. And of those planets that can develop intelligent life, the fraction of those civilizations have to be determined who develop a technology that releases detectable signs of their existence into space, namely things like radio signals. And lastly is the length of time that such a civilization can release the detectable signals into space. So that's the Drake equation. And again, it's been used since 1961 or so, and has been used to this very day. Now, I'd make the case that it's fairly arbitrary and fairly obsolete now. There's got to be a different way that we can go about projecting and thinking about how many extraterrestrial civilizations exist out there and how we might be able to communicate with them. Now, the integers that are plugged into this equation, they're often subject to wide interpretation, and they can differ significantly from scientist to scientist. Even the slightest change can result in vastly different answers, and part of the problem is that our understanding of cosmology and astrobiology is rapidly changing, literally on a daily basis, and there's often very little consensus among specialists as to what the variables might be. Consequently, the Drake formula relies on stabs in the dark, and this makes it highly imprecise and unscientific. The margin of error is far beyond what should be considered acceptable or meaningful. Now, another major problem of the Drake equation is that it does not account for two rather important variables, cosmological developmental phases and time. More specifically, it does not take into consideration such factors as the age of the galaxy, the time at which intelligence first emerged, or the presence of physiochemical variables necessary for the presence of life, things like metallicity that are required to form planets. The equation assumes a sort of cosmological uniformity instead of a rather dynamic and ever-changing universe. For example, the equation asks us to guess the number of Earth-like planets, but it does not ask us when there were Earth-like planets. And intelligence itself may have been present as long as 2 to 4.5 billion years ago, if not more. The galaxy's extreme age and the potential for intelligence to have emerged at disparate points in time leaves an absurdly narrow window for detecting radio signals. The distances and timescales in question are mind-bogglingly vast. SETI, under its current model, is conducting an incredibly futile search. Which leads to the next problem, and that's of quantifying the number of radio-emitting civilizations. Now, I'm sure that back in the 1960s, it made a lot of sense to think of radio capability as a fairly advanced and ubiquitous means of communication, and by consequence, an excellent way to detect the presence and frequency of extraterrestrial civilizations. But time is proving that this assumption may be wrong. Our radio window is quickly closing, and it'll only be a matter of time before Earth stops transmitting these types of signals, at least unintentionally. There's such a thing known as active SETI, which I'll have to talk about it in some other podcast. It's a proactive attempt to contact extraterrestrials with radio signals. Now, because of this revelation, the entire equation as a means to both classify and quantify certain types of civilizations becomes quite meaningless and arbitrary. At best, it's a way of searching for a very narrow class of civilizations under extremely and excruciatingly specific and constrained conditions. Rather, SETI should continue to redefine the ways in which ETIs could be detected. They should try to predict future means of communication, like quantum communication schemes, and ways to identify these signals. They should also look for artificial objects, like megascale engineering and artificial calling cards. In terms of megascale engineering, they should look for Dyson-type structures, Dysonian structures. And in terms of artificial objects, they should look for what are called transit light curve signatures of artificial objects. And that's, I think, Luc Arnold's theory, is that that extraterrestrials, in order to get our attention, would put rather large geometrically obvious and artificial objects in front of stars that we would see them. So, for example, suddenly a square would move in front of a solar object, be obvious that that's artificial. Now, although possibly outside the auspices of this discussion, the Drake equation does not account for the presence of post-radio capable civilizations, particularly post-singularity machine intelligences. This is a problem because of what these types of civilizations might be capable of. The equation is used to determine the number of radio-capable civs as they conduct their business on their home planet. And again, this is a very narrow view of ETIs and the space of all possible advanced civilizational types. Moreover, it does not account for any migratory tendency that advanced civs may have. The Drake equation does not tell us about exponential civilizational growth on account of von Neumann probe disbursement. It does not tell us where advanced ETIs may be dwelling or what they're up to. For example, are they outside the galaxy? Do they live inside Jupiter brains? Do they phase shift outside of what we regard as habitable space, and so on? And this is a serious shortcoming because the answers to these questions should help us determine not just where we should be looking, but they can also provide us with insight as to the makeup of advanced intelligent life and our own potential trajectory. In other words, post-singularity ETIs may represent the most common mode of existence for late-stage civilizations, and that's who we should be looking for, rather than radio-transmitting civilizations. Michael Crichton once put out a very weak argument against the Drake Equation. He claimed that SETI was a religious endeavor because it was a search for imaginary entities. He's wrong, of course. We should most certainly search for data where we think we might find it. I believe, despite the low odds, that it is reasonable to assume that our search for life on other planets is warranted. Even a negative result can be meaningful. Consequently, SETI should keep listening, but expect to hear nothing. If we should suddenly hear something from the depths of space, then we have to seriously reevaluate some of our assumptions. At the same time, we should find better ways to detect advanced life and tweak the Drake Equation in such a way as to account for the missing variables and factors I mentioned earlier. Again, and more generally, we should probably adopt the contact pessimists' frame. Back in the 60s and 70s, when the contact optimists like Sagan, Shklovsky, and Drake ruled the Earth, it was not uncommon to think that N in the equation fell somewhere between a million to even a billion. These days, in the post-Tipler and Hart era of astrosociobiology, cosmologists and astrobiologists have to take such factors into consideration as von Neumann probes, the Fermi paradox, the rare Earth hypothesis, stronger variants of the anthropic principles, and catastrophism. Put another way, as we continue to search for advanced ETIs, and as we come to discover the absurdity of our isolation here on Earth, we may have no choice but to accept the hypothesis that advanced life does not venture out into space for whatever reason, the most likely being self-destruction. Our other option is to cross our fingers and hope that something radical and completely unpredictable lies on the other side of the technological singularity. Looking everywhere. I've been closely following the exploits of Anonymous with no small amount of fascination. For those who are living in a cave, Anonymous is a hacktivist group that has made headlines by declaring war on the Church of Scientology and by launching several initiatives to that end, some legal, some not so legal. Now, at first, I was delighted by the news. Finally, I thought somebody's actually doing something about this blight of Scientology. As many of you know, I'm not a fan of Scientology. I've spoken out against their unscrupulousness for quite some time now. I have friends who have been persecuted by the cult, and I know of others who have been caught in their brainwashing web. I've also had my own run-ins with the group and some of their drones. But the more I think about the actions of Anonymous and what they're doing, the more I am convinced that they're going about their campaign in the wrong way. Sure, there are advantages to this devil-may-care approach and all the publicity that they get because of it, but ultimately I think their strategy is going to fail. They're stooping down to the level of the Scientologists and engaging in illegal activities, and this puts them at considerable risk. And at the same time, they are undermining more legitimate efforts that may see Scientology finally branded as the antisocial, money-grubbing racket that it is. Now, Anonymous, they first emerged this past January in response to Scientology's rather laughable effort to ban that scandalous video of Tom Cruise enthusiastically praising the virtues of Scientology. Anonymous launched their campaign and they called it Project Kenology. I guess that's how it's pronounced, Kenology or Kenology. And they publicly launched this creepy as hell YouTube video called Message to Scientology, and they did this on January the 21st. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend you take a look at it. It's really quite interestingly done. And in the video, Anonymous accuses Scientology of promoting internet censorship. And at the same time, they declare their own goal of working to see Scientology expelled from the internet. Anonymous, which appears to be made up of disparate collection of hackers and activists, they state that they are, quote, everyone and everywhere and have no leaders. Following the release of the video, Anonymous launched a number of denial-of-service attacks, black faxes, prank calls, and other measures meant to disrupt Scientology's operations. But earlier this month, Anonymous, they moved to some more legal methods, including an attempt to get the U.S. Internal Revenue Service to investigate the Church of Scientology's tax-exempt status. Anonymous also organized a number of worldwide protests, and these turned out to be extremely successful. Participants were invited to put on a mask so that they could retain their anonymity and protest outside Scientology facilities. Now, to my amazement, the Toronto rally attracted nearly 50 masked protesters, and similar scenes like this were played out in over 90 locations around the world and involved as much as 7,000 protesters. That's a huge success. And without a doubt, Anonymous has done more in the past 2 months than any other group to make it socially acceptable to protest against Scientology. By disingenuously hiding behind the shield of religious freedom and by relentlessly harassing its critics, Scientology has thus far successfully quashed any attempt at protest and action. Now, Anonymous is changing this. Thanks to their high-profile campaign, illegal or otherwise, they have raised awareness and made it possible for people to feel that, you know what, they can organize and they can protest against the cult. And this may, in fact, turn out to be their greatest victory. The publicity spawned by these efforts may eventually instigate political action. And it has been this utter lack of political action in North America in particular that has forced groups, and a clandestine vigilante group, to emerge in the first place. Meanwhile, in Europe, you've got countries like Germany and France who are working to ban Scientology. You have ministers that have proposed bills to ban the group based on the fact that they violate human rights and then take advantage of vulnerable people and that they're antisocial. But it's a different story here in North America. We have a rather misguided mandate to unquestioningly honor all forms of religious expression. And it's created a loophole for Scientology, which have enabled it to spread its memetic cancer. And virtually nobody does anything about it, and those few who do are ignored or they're declared to be intolerant. Which is why Anonymous has emerged and why they feel they have to take matters into their own hands. Unfortunately, they have decided to launch some questionable practices of their own, like these denial-of-service attacks. While there's a certain satisfaction in seeing Scientology on the receiving end, it's not a long-term strategy, not a viable long-term strategy. It's clearly a form of harassment, and in fact, authorities have already been involved. And a worst-case scenario may see Anonymous's members being charged with instigating hate crimes. That is assuming, of course, that its members can be uncovered, which brings to mind a whole other issue, and that is, given the fact that this group is supposedly distributed without leadership and is completely collaborative, can there be such a thing as distributed guilt? How do you, let's assume that for the sake of argument that there's hundreds of people involved, would all 100 people be found guilty? Interesting question. These approaches may also perpetuate a persecution complex among the Scientologists themselves and prompt them to defend their religious freedoms even further. As Scientology critic Andreas Heldal Lund has said, quote, attacking Scientology like that will make them play the religious persecution card. They will use it to defend their own counteractions when they try to shatter criticism and crush critics without mercy. Ultimately, Anonymous's goal of wanting to have Scientology wiped off the internet, it will fail. And that's showcased by the Tom Cruise video that when an attempt is made to remove something from the internet, the opposite actually happens. And this is what's referred to as the Streisand effect. You can Google that for more information. Moreover, legal tactics will only take away from those genuine efforts that could actually work to see Scientology legislated into oblivion. If France and Germany can work to do it, so can the US and Canada. And finally, because Anonymous has proven effective at generating publicity and for its masterly methods at organizing dissent, they really should concentrate their energy and skills in this particular area. By getting people out into the streets and by broadcasting the sins of Scientology, political and legal action may soon follow. This is a process that will require patience, persistence, and action. As Trey Parker and Matt Stone have proclaimed, the million-year war for Earth has only just begun. Well, thank you for joining me today. That's it for today's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, I'm going to recount the tracks that I played. The first track was from Battle of Mice, and the track was entitled Salt Bridge. Following that was a great post-metal band called Russian Circles, and the track was called Carpe. And the third track was Blonde Redhead's Dr. Strangelove. Okay, that ends today's broadcast. Hopefully next week I won't be so stuffy and congested and I'll sound like my old self again. Until then, have yourselves a wonderful week. Bye-bye.